Hi, good morning everyone. How is everyone feeling? Good? That's good. Alright, welcome to this concurrent session, International Motor Trends, presented by Kitty Ho. My name is Danielle and I will be chairing this session. So a tiny bit of housekeeping first. This session will run for about 40 minutes, so finish around 12:55. There will be an hour of lunch following this before the afternoon sessions start at 1:55. Also, if I could remind you to fill in the very short feedback form on the GIS 2016 website, that will be very much appreciated. I'll give a very quick introduction of our presenter, Kitty Ho, now. Kitty is a qualified actuary. She started her career as a consultant in PwC, and she moved into the world of reinsurance 9 years ago when she joined Munich Re. Her background is primarily in casualty classes of business, having had roles in reserving, risk management, pricing, and underwriting. Her key area of interest is motor, including CTP. More recently, she spent 2 years working at her company's headquarters in Munich and was involved in working on pricing models for European motor markets. With the research she started there, it triggered her curiosity in the developments of motor insurance markets globally. And today, she will be sharing some of her findings with all of us. Please join me in welcoming Kitty Ho.
Thank you, Danielle. The most important word of insurance was omitted from my title, so it's actually International Motor Insurance Trends. So if you're here to hear about the newest Tesla model, sorry, I can't give that to you, but hopefully you guys are interested in insurance, so that's why you're here. Don't know what's the best way. Here we go. So the agenda for today's presentation, I know that a lot of aspects can be covered when you talk about motor insurance, but I thought, given this is an actuarial conference, we should talk about the basics of claim frequency and average claim size trends. I also thought there are a couple of issues which the Australian markets are confronted with lately, and I thought I'd share with my findings on those issues and how that's been dealt with in other countries with you today. So these include claims fraud, having a bad risk pool, product distribution, telematics, and I think I can't talk about motor insurance today without mentioning something on autonomous vehicles. So in terms of some statistics, what I've got on the slide here is basically just telling you which countries I've selected in terms of statistics to show you today. I mean, these countries are selected based on the data availability, what I could find on the internet in terms of finding out their claim frequency and average claim sizes, and also dependent on their product groupings. So what I mean is, in Australia, we see basically the motor own damage and TPPD sort of grouped together, and then the CTP statistics come separately. But in the other markets, especially Europe, they actually see it in a different way. They sort of see motor own damage as one segment, while the third party, be it bodily injury or property damage, that's usually grouped together. So where I could, I'd try to split them out so I can compare them back to the Australian market stats. On the graph there, I thought just to let you know the premium volumes of the countries we're talking about today. Obviously, US is the outlier, but in general, motor markets do take up about 30 to 50% of the available non-life market premium. So motor own damage, as you can see on the graph on the left-hand side, you've got claim frequency, which in general tends to be trending downwards, and I guess that's to be expected given the general trend towards improvement in safety on roads. But also it's driven a lot by economic factors. So since the GFC, there's been a slowdown in the economy, which reduces fuel consumption. And also, if fuel prices are rising, that will also reduce the claim frequency as well. And in that graph, you can see Brazil being the exception. So they've actually had really good GDP growth between the years 2010 and 2014. So their frequency has gone up, but everyone else has gone slightly down. And interestingly, in an international motor fatality frequency trends report, they find that during times of recession, not only fewer kilometres are driven on the road, but the proportion driven by younger drivers also reduces. So hence the claim frequency improves. Now on the right-hand side, we've got average claim size graphs. And as you can see, it is sort of flattish and then sort of increasing slightly for the last couple of years. And that's most likely to be attributable to more expensive car parts as new car technologies become available. I'll just go through this slide really quickly as well. I mean, this is for third-party property damage, and the trends are actually very similar to motor-owned damage. So reducing claim frequency and slight increase on average claim size. So for comparability with the Australian market, I combined the motor own damage and TPPD classes together to present to you these pictures. So on the graph on the left, you can see Australia in the light blue there, sort of also on that slight reduction, and it's sitting sort of in the middle-ish, about 15% or so in claim frequency. On the right-hand side graph, though, you see that our average claim size is probably a little bit lower than the other countries in the same comparison graph. So we're actually, it's very similar in claim sizes globally, actually, when you talk about property damage. Now, this one is about third-party bodily injury. So here we know it as CTP. Again, the frequency is sort of flattish to decreasing. The only exception there you see is Italy. So that red line on the left-hand side shows a rather sharp decrease in the year 2011, and that's driven by legislative change. So they've set in a new law with provisions against speculative claims for very mild injuries, principally whiplashes, and changes to eligibility requirements for compensation. So there's a big drop in claim frequency as a result. Now, the right-hand graph was one that got me really curious, because the average claim size is there. In Australia, we know it's roughly about $110,000, $120,000. And Canada, interestingly, has sort of comparable average claim sizes too. But all the other countries which I've looked into, US and also some European markets, their average claim sizes are much lower. So I went and talked to my US colleagues, and I found out that basically it's because the legal requirements for the policy limits are much lower. So legal limits over there probably is roughly $25,000 to $30,000 per accident. That's a legal requirement. People usually buy a little bit higher, maybe at about $100,000. But even so, it actually means that the average claim sizes come in a lot lower than Australia and Canada. And in Europe, they also have limits on third-party liability claims as well. So I thought that was quite interesting. Now, then I go into the topic of claims fraud. I thought for the professor this, I picked Canada and Italy to see what those countries are doing about the claims fraud issues. So in Canada, in 2014, they've introduced a legislation change. It's quite specific. It's called Fighting Fraud and Reducing Automobile Insurance Rates Act. So in terms of trying to reduce, so they actually saw similar issues that Australian markets saw, rising premium rates because of more claims coming in, et cetera, et cetera. So the first four dot points on my slide basically highlight what they did in order to try and to reduce those insurance rates. So they've simplified their claims resolution system. They wanted to protect consumers from sneaky toll truck drivers by making sure that all toll trucks must be registered. They've also made changes to the benefit scheme design itself by changing minor injury claims guidelines, and also changes to the benefits coverage, reducing the duration that they can claim for from 10 to 5 years. In order to tackle claims fraud, they've established a not-for-profit organisation called Kinetics, which uses analytical tools to identify suspicious claims. So when they So what happens is they used all the insurance industry pool data to facilitate investigation further by the individual insurers. And if they've identified suspicious activities, then this particular database generate alerts to the insurers, and it is in their court to investigate those claims further or report them to the police. In Italy, basically their approach is also similar in terms of establishing an integrated anti-fraud database. And what they've done there is they basically try to link in as many external or private or public databases as possible in order to assess the credibility of a claim. So the regulator over there have linked up their claims database with the National Motor Vehicle Registry, Driver's License Database, Central Injury Archive, Database of Vehicle and Document Thefts and Losses, Tax Database, and National Databases of Residents. And what happens is every motor liability claim has to be consulted against that database. And based on the findings of that consultation, every claim that's reported to that database will be given a score indicating its degree of anomaly. If the score is low or nil, then the insurer who submitted that claim will know, but they'll get a result of low score with no additional information. However, if the score comes back to be medium or high, then the insurer will be informed of the scores for the vehicle and the persons involved, as well as codes of the specific indicators of anomaly that produced a high score, and the names of the other insurers that are handling the claims related to the same license plate or tax numbers. And then these insurance companies will be alerted in turn by special information flow. So that it's a problematic claim, they get a bit more information. And then as a result, this database gets constantly updated, all the indicators are recalculated, and so this database becomes quite useful in identifying fraudulent claims quite quickly. So I just came from Raj's presentation, and we know that CIRA has consulted a consultancy to look at the history of claims, but maybe the next step forward is to make it into a real-time interrogation so the insurers can act up immediately. I thought I'd talk a little bit about bad risks pool, only because I read in the New South Wales CTP reforms paper that that's something that's proposed. Basically, if the difficult risks are pooled together, the concept of risk pooling. I'll make this quick. Basically, all the countries that I looked at, there are three options. Either there is no bad risk pool, of which Australia is one of them at the moment. The other option is, as you can see with those countries on the right, if a particular policy or a particular risk is rejected by three companies, then the insurance association can allocate the risk to a particular insurer, but setting based on specific terms and conditions such as premium and deductibles. Let's go quickly through the next one as well. Or the third option that I've seen is basically all the special risks, like in Korea, all the special risks go into this pool. So risks with poor claim records, high cars, tourist coaches, buses, etc. They're pooled together, and then they're managed by Korean Re. The company that seed the risk retains 30% of it, but distributes the balance to the other pool members. So if it's loss-making, then it's spread against other insurers. Next, just one quick slide on distribution. It's quite an outdated topic, but why did I want to talk about it today is because a question triggered me was, given the rise of internet, I just wanted to find out how much of it has changed the way that insurance is purchased. And from my research, my conclusion is actually not a lot. The distribution of motor insurance is still very much dominated by agents and brokers. And there are some countries with more direct sales. As you can see, Australia is one of them, and then UK, US. So what has the internet changed? Well, sales are actually limited through the internet. And generally what happens is the internet is used for information and promotional purposes and comparison sites. But after all the research that's done, usually people still pick up the phone and ring whatever choice they end up making and trying to get the deal done there on the phone. Next is telematics. Telematics got a bit of limelight a few years ago, being the next thing for motor insurance. So I just thought, looked into that and see how globally that's been doing or what insurers have been doing. So there have been a lot of pilots in progress, and mainly use of telematics is to collect information on driving behaviour and then through that attract lower risk drivers and being more competitive. However, there's a lot of regulatory issues and privacy concerns for use of telematics. So an example is in the state of Ontario in Canada, insurance companies cannot use the data they collect to increase a driver's rate, cancel the policy, or make a claims decision. They can only use the data they collect to give a discount. So, they did a survey there to say that half of the Canadian drivers are interested in buying a user-based insurance policy, but they also have strong concern over privacy as well. In Denmark, they've used telematics, or this particular company in Denmark used this particular company in Denmark, Alka, used telematics to record the speed before and after accident. If the recorded speed was 5 kilometres per hour higher than the speed limit, then an extra deductible is imposed. So it's the extra deductible imposed of 1,000 Danish kroner, which is roughly 200 Australian dollars per kilometre per hour. It cost the policyholder 1,000 Danish kroner to install the device, but they can have their premium cut by 25%. The device is also good for finding stolen vehicles and summon ambulance help in case of accidents. I also looked into Japan and Korea as well, given they are known for their car manufacturing industries. So in Japan, we've got Sony and Mitsui using smartphone apps to monitor the quality of driving in order to offer discounts or their mileage. New Toyota cars through Aoi and new Nissan cars through Sampo, they have on their cars pay-as-you-drive premium system. So again, reducing the premium. However, even in Japan, drivers, there's some observers which doubt whether the technology will widely spread. Firstly, because drivers are said to resent the idea of being spied upon. So again, privacy concerns. And the other issue is the insurers are actually terrified of their loss of premium income that will be resulted from acknowledging how very few miles the Japanese actually drive. In Korea, they've also got pay-as-you-drive policies. It's like low-mileage policies as well. So how it works is they've got a device which tracks the estimate, annual mileage, and the device is to check that the actual mileage driven, how that compares to the estimated mileage for which the premium is initially based on, is not exceeded. They get premium discounts if they can drive for less than, say, 3,000, 5,000 kilometres per year. This type of policy is actually quite popular in Korea, so about 12% of the drivers would go for this low mileage option, and the government is offering state sponsorship to develop fully fledged telematics technology as well. However, no insurer is actually keen to take the lead on this for two reasons. Firstly, there's a huge cost of trialing telematics product widely enough and for long enough in order to get regulator approval for a proposed premium structure. And the other issue is there's a disincentive that the pioneer insurer might be forced to share its trial data with its competitors. So with all that, As my background setting, I guess, just want to touch on autonomous vehicles. There are quite a few presentations in this seminar about this topic, but what I want to focus on is actually just a picture for the next 5 to 10 years. I'll go through just those topics on my slide there. What I think about transition to driverless cars, what will happen with respect to claims and pricing, and the importance of considering the bigger picture, how it will relate to public policies and sharing economy, etc. So when will driverless cars become available? I've got two ends of the spectrum here. Will it be 2020? According to Carlos Gons, the CEO of Nissan, he says that by the end of 2016, which is only 6 weeks away, Nissan will make available the next two technologies under its autonomous drive strategy. 2020 will be the absolute deadline for Nissan to introduce self-driving vehicles to market. And on the other hand of the spectrum, there's a report by PwC which says there's typically a 15-year span between the initial introduction of a new technology and 95% new vehicle models availability. It takes an additional 15 years, or 30 years in total, to reach 95% of all vehicle availability. So I'll leave it to the audience to have a think about when this driverless car will become available. I guess my personal take on it is I think that while the technology is advancing really quickly, the rate of adoption, there will be a lot of human factors, including company commitments and regulator involvement, that will probably slow that down. So transition to driverless cars, this is just, I guess, a pictorial way or showing what I mean. So if we think about the cars today as conventional non-automatic vehicles, what will become more common on the roads in the near future, next 5 to 10 years, would be that middle category of semi-automated vehicles. So cars with driver assistance where, intelligent cruise control, lane-keeping mechanisms, you can drive on the highway hands-free. And then you'll move towards sort of conditional automation or towards fully automated self-driving vehicles. I guess the way I see it is my daughter, who's 5, when she gets her driver's license in 10, 15 years' time, and I'd be asked to do parallel parking, all she needs to do is drive it up to the right spot and she'll probably press a button and off the car parks. Whereas for my grandchildren, they probably don't even need a driver's license. So what will happen to claims experience and claims resolution? I think with improvement in technology and realising that a lot of accidents now are human errors, the expectation is there will be a reduction in collision frequency for new vehicles. However, that's offset by increasing complexity and cost of repairs. In terms of claims resolution, this topic is very much talked about, where the fault lies, who's responsible, will it become more product liability given the accident might be caused by a car manufacturer defect. I think most of you have heard all that before. What will happen to pricing? Well, obviously it will be a challenge because we don't have any data on these semi-automated vehicles yet. What their collision experience is like, will the car manufacturers make it available? Will there be a black box on that car which tells you when those driver assistant features are engaged? So it will be a challenge for our insurance industry. Although what we can consider is there are other transportation such as aircraft, ships and trains which are actually quite automated, so we can look at those classes of business and see how pricing is done there. So in the next 10 years, according to a paper done by the Insurance Institute Canada, they think that over the next 10 years, conventional vehicles will account for 70 to 90% of the kilometres driven. Semi-automated cars will account for another 10 to 25%, and self-driving vehicles will likely to account for less than 5%. Now, just pause there for a minute. This is just a projection of sort of cars, sort of types of vehicles driven on the road. But can I just do a quick survey around the room? Hands up if you bought a new car in the last 5 years. Can you keep them up if you think you know how to use some of the features? Half the features, let's say. Can you keep them up if you think you know how to use all the features? Can you keep them up if you think, if you've actually read the car manual? Well, precisely. So I guess my quick survey is similar to this national survey that's also done in Canada. It's called Vehicle Safety Features, Knowledge, Perceptions and Driving Habits. And they've got three very interesting findings. So the first finding they had was less than one third of the drivers are familiar with modern safety features. Most do not know the features on the vehicle they're driving, nor do they know how they should best be used. Another interesting finding is many drivers believe they can react faster and drive better than the features offered by the new safety technology, despite considerable evidence that assistance would make them better drivers. And a third finding, which is probably one of most concern, is that a number of drivers disclosed that the vehicle with vehicle automation, they will take more risks, such as driving when fatigued or distracted. They also disclosed that they may increase their aggressive behavior, such as tailgating. So something for the insurance industry to think about as well. So I guess back to the building blocks of the start of my presentation. We were talking about frequency and average claim sizes. In a KPMG report, they projected that over the next 10 years, with more semi-automated vehicles on the roads, there will be a 35 to 40% reduction in collisions frequency. That's offset by a 25 to 30% increase in cost of repairs. And if you do the maths, that gives you about a 10% reduction in average cost per vehicle in the next 10 years, roughly a 1% change per year. There's also a study done by Swiss Re as well, which basically concluded that auto insurance claims and revenues in advanced countries like Canada are expected to be largely unchanged over the next decade or two. A study by PwC predicts that an 8% reduction in total insurance payments for auto collision claims by 2025 in the United States. So those three studies all sort of came to the same conclusion that over the next 10 years, there won't be a significant reduction according to sort of improvement in technology. But I guess if you look at a broader horizon of 30, 40 years, the story could be very different. I'll just skip this exercise rather quickly, but it just discusses the legal responsibility issue in terms of determining liability for motor claims. And the key message here is the design of insurance coverage really need to evolve to match those changes. And how would this fit into the big picture, such as including public policy and the sharing economy? So government policies and funding on transportation systems, it could accelerate, but I guess it could also hinder the development of driverless vehicles being put on roads. So Elon Musk, who's the CEO of Tesla, he believes that some additional time will be needed to secure regulatory approval in order to introduce driverless vehicles onto the roads. The other factor to consider is sharing economy. We're likely to reduction in car ownership. And the investment bank Barclays forecast that basically the number of owned vehicles will reduce by 50% over the next 25 years. And that brings me to the conclusion of my presentation. And I found this very interesting quote by Warren Buffett and his view on autonomous vehicles. So thank you, but please, any questions or feedback?
Thank you very much, Kitty. That's a very informative session. We have about five or 10 minutes to take some questions. Does anyone want to ask a question? Yes, please. If you could come to the micro. Yeah.
Former Q.
Do you
want
to?
So if you go back to your slide, I think it was a KPMG report which talked about there'll be a 35-40% reduction in number of vehicles and...
Plane
frequency, but cost is going to increase.
Yep.
That's obviously average cost, not total cost.
No.
Yeah. Yep. So that's going to destroy the insurance market. It's basically what Warren's saying, correct?
Yeah. So I think the claim frequency will reduce, but it will just pose more challenge to the insurance industry.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I think people only see one side of the coin.
Precisely.
Thinking
when, better when you say there's going to be a 1% change, that might be a 1% change in terms of average cost, but the total pool is going to shrink.
Yep.
By a massive amount.
Yes.
Which is going to have enormous repercussions for the insurance industry.
Yep. Okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, so if there's no party at the insurance company, like what should we do to, I guess...
That's my question for you.
Because the murder, as we all know, is pretty big in terms of the... GWP pool for the insurers. Yeah. So if there's no need for this stuff, So any guidance from, the industry research?
I don't think I'm experienced enough to give anyone guidance in this room, maybe except to go to Graham's session tomorrow, who will touch on that. But yeah, I think...
Yes, that's great, Matt Affinity. My view is that actually there is a future for motor insurance for a long time, probably 30 years. And it goes to some of the numbers that you've said there, Kitty, that it's going to be quite some time before the technology is not just rolled out, but it's becoming very common on the streets. It'll be many years before that happens. So my view is that car insurance, motor insurance will be around for a long time, yeah.
To that point, is there compatibility between driverless and non-driverless cars on the road, or does it have to be legislated to actually get to the point where where you can do away with insurance as we know it today and have the motor vehicle provider and programmer actually take on that risk?
So we understand there's about 200 state federal laws in Australia required to be changed to bring about the full driverless economy. It's going to be a long time before that comes in. So whilst the technology will be there in the next few years, I think it's going to be decades before two things. First of all, us as a society willing to embrace driverless cars, and secondly, that the legislative framework has been changed to allow it to happen.
And the problem with that, though, is that the market signal for continuing to develop the technology, it can't be rewarded. So, the reward will not be there until driverless cars are in practice. So how does the technology develop without a natural reward?
Yeah, well, that's a good thought. I guess it has developed today because it's seen as a marketable piece of technology that we're doing the vehicle.
It could be a safety issue. So, the government, the signal could well be from government regulators saying, look, it's in everybody's interest for this to happen. It's going to be a cost. But, in terms of moving regulation, without the government's
on that. So sort of a transition through semi into more and more until it gets automated and legislated along the way through instead.
Yeah, you have to be legislated.
Will all those driver's cars stick to the left-hand side so we can overtake around the edge?
I think that's one of the issues too. It'll be quite a challenge on the roads because there'll be people who want to test driverless cars to see, well, how is it going to respond?
While KPMG forecasts obviously this nice picture of reduction in frequency, but if you think about it in reality, there'll be a mixture of conventional cars versus, semi-automatic cars versus driverless vehicles. And
it's going to be dangerous.
Exactly, So who will be at fault?
Special lanes.
Yeah, special lanes.
Transit lane for
So I wouldn't actually be surprised if the frequency initially goes up, because everyone's still adapting to the technology as well. The technology itself is still learning as well, you know, from the mistakes that each other makes, that each other, the cars themselves make. So
I would have thought also that they would have to hire up their cyber security as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially if that person's like me, who's driving their car to be true.
I think it raises a really good point about increasing frequency. Also, I think, like, what we see with age, why is older drivers better? Because they have the driving experience. But once these driverless cars come, they might have lesser experience driving, so you might see that age curve change, and then that will also
definitely,
you have more worse drivers around, because they're not driving as much. Because half the time they use driverless technology, half the time they want to drive for leisure, and then you can see, you might have high frequency because of that as well.
Yep. That's great. I think we are almost running out of time, so please put your hands together and thank Kitty for a great session.